Hi, welcome to In Sync, the podcast that explores the history and impact of some of your favorite music moments in TV and film. I'm your host, Rachel Brodsky.
And I think I'm the voice of my generation, or a voice of a generation.
Nearly 12 years after it first debuted on HBO, Girls, a show about four millennial 20-somethings trying and flailing to assemble their lives in New York City, remains as topical as ever, with seemingly endless podcasts and TikToks dedicated to discussing its characters and storylines.
Created by and starring Lena Dunham and executive produced by Judd Apatow, Girls ran for six seasons between 2012 and 2017 and arguably launched the careers of actors like Adam Driver, Eben Moss Bachrach, Andrew Rannells, and Allison Williams, among many others.
Along with Michael Penn's acoustic score, Girls featured a spectrum of contemporary needle drops ranging from pitchforky indie rock selections to mainstream and classic pop, all under the music supervision of Manish Raval, Tom Wolfe, and Jonathan Leahy.
One of the most defining selections happens in season one, episode three, entitled All Adventurous Women Do, where Lena Dunham's Hannah Horvath and roommate Marnie Michaels, played by Allison Williams, are dancing with abandon in their Greenpoint apartment to Robin's iconic 2010 club banger, Dancing on My Own.
Here to help us unpack this scene is TikTok star, comedian, and podcaster Jake Shane. Also, I apologize in advance to Aviv, who is probably going to be outnumbered during this conversation in who likes girls and who doesn't.
Much like Hannah's ex in this episode, I don't care for girls.
So how did Dancing on My Own end up in this girl scene? What did Robin herself make of the placement? And will Aviv ever forgive me for making him watch Girls?
No.
All this and more on the latest episode of In Sync.
All adventurous women do.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh my God. Okay, well, that was amazing.
Thank you.
Who's this voice that's joined us?
Oh, it's Jake. It's me. Hi, guys.
Hi, Jake.
Hi, Jake.
Jake, thank you so much for being here with us. We are so happy to have you. Aviv sent me your TikTok about this needle drop in particular. We both laughed. We both cried. We both want to know more about you. Tell us about yourself, what you do, your new podcast, Therapus.
Yes.
You have a podcast. Yes. And please, floor is yours.
Well, hi, everyone. Hi, all In Sync listeners. First of all, thank you guys for having me.
Thank you for coming on. This is a dream come true.
You know what? When I saw this come through, I was like, oh my God, this sounds like my wet dream. Like, I live for like needle drop moments in like television. You know what I mean?
Ooh.
Especially television.
Like, oh my God.
Just like, I love a good sink. I love a good sink. Like,
so you're coming back is what you're saying. You're gonna be a repeat guest.
I'm coming back. Like, I'm ready to talk. Like, there are like, cause you know, music really makes or breaks a show or an episode. Like, you know, like Scandal had like a primarily jazz focused soundtrack, which
for
really
real, yeah.
just like it just creates the environment and like makes it work. If that makes sense, I feel like I sound like an idiot, but
anyway. No. I totally agree. I think we haven't really talked about this in like our 25 episodes or whatever, but like it helps fill out the world, the size and scope of the world by just kind of existing within the scene or on the soundtrack. And it does do this kind of amazing magic trick of creating the rest of the world in the mind of the viewer. First, I want to know about your connection to girls in general. Do you love the show? Do you hate the show?
I die for the show.
You die for the show.
I watched it while it was on air, and I actually started watching it because of this scene, because I was always reading like BuzzFeed or Entertainment Weekly or whatever, and in those publications, they were talking about this scene in particular because it trended on Twitter so massively after it came out. And I think I was in like sixth or seventh grade. So I started watching it, and I watched it up until Hannah obviously goes to Iowa. But I remember not really, I remember finding it so funny, but not appreciating or understanding the situations that these characters oftentimes found themselves in. Now, this was my first rewatch. So rewatching it like was such a, I was like, oh my God, wait, like, am I Hannah?
Now you're around the age that Hannah and her friends are. So it's like a very different perspective.
I was going to say, I didn't know for sure, but I thought that you might be a smidge younger than us old millennials. And because I watched the show around the same age as Lena Dunham and her contemporaries, and feeling, well, first of all, I do love to rewatch the show because I think that it's understood a little bit better as a satire now.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas at the time, I think it was viewed as like, are they really doing this? Is this really happening? And I know for me, trying to ascend in my own similar, like early 20 something age, I was like, why would you do that? That's so stupid. Why would you do? I can't believe that you're doing that. And that's why it was hurting me internally, because I was like trying to say yes and be nice all the time and not make a scene.
Right.
So this is my first, I watched the first three episodes of Girls for the first time today for this show. And so I have I'm wrestling with a similar question of like, what is or isn't satire? But if you, like me, are new to the show Girls, I want to give our listeners, I want to give a quick explainer about how Girls came to be. So Girls' creative force is Lena Dunham. Her father, Carol Dunham, is a painter, and her mother, Lori Simmons, is an artist, photographer, and filmmaker. We'll hear more about Lori in a little bit. While a student at Oberlin College, which itself has become a punchline for like a wealthy liberal haven for professional online concern trolls, Lena started making shorts inspired by early and mid 2000s mumblecore filmmaking.
Oh yeah, very Greta Gerwig.
So Lena and Greta are in like second wave mumblecore.
Mm.
Mumblecore is a filmmaking style that has natural, often improvised dialogue, sometimes using non-actors, low budgets. And it sort of was a marriage of like movies like of Gen X malaise, like Reality Bites or Clerks or something, and this Dogma 95 movement in Europe, which emphasized verisimilitude over everything and even forbade things like lights. Like you couldn't set up lights for your scene in a Dogma 95 film.
Jake, I learn a lot about film when we make
this. I was about to say, like, I was sitting here like, am I supposed to know this? Like I'm actually like looking, I'm like,
the most I know about mumblecore is like I saw Hannah Takes the Stairs once.
So, so depending on who you ask, I'll explain why I know about this in particular. I'm a film professor, but I'll explain why I know about this in particular in a second. So the godfathers of mumblecore are people like Andrew Bujalski, Joe Swanberg, who you may or may not have heard of. Joe Swanberg directed Hannah Takes the Stairs, and Jay and Mark Duplass, who are kind of the most famous of these mumblecore filmmakers. Andrew Bujalski, I'm the same age as Lena Dunham. And so I, too, as someone who attended college and started making films in this era, like mumblecore was the hotness in 2005. And the college that I went to, Boston University, Andrew Bujalski, the father of mumblecore, taught in my first semester film class as he was like finishing up one of his films. And so everyone,
my school got a film major halfway through my tenure.
As a result of this, everybody I went to college with became obsessed with this mumblecore style of filmmaking.
Right. Okay.
And so the second wave of mumblecore movies included filmmakers like Greta Gerwig, who very famously got snubbed for an Academy Award this year for directing the Barbie movie.
What does she have to do?
So many fucking thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is not the time or the place, but there are thoughts.
Josh and Benny Safdie, who I went to college with, and Lena Dunham with her first 2010
You went to college with the Safdie brothers?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I was in between the ages of Josh and Benny, and I knew Benny a little bit, but I never really hung out with Josh at all. But I was Benny's lighting TA in one class. So Lena Dunham and her 2010 feature directorial debut, Tiny Furniture, was another one of these second wave mumblecore movies. Tiny Furniture functions as a low-budget prequel to Girls, though the names are changed. Dunham plays the lead role of Aura. Laurie Simmons, her real-life mother, plays Aura's mother. And Lena's real-life sibling, Cyrus, plays Aura's on-screen sibling. And for her work on Tiny Furniture, Lena won an Independent Spirit Award for Best First Screenplay. And the film itself won Best Narrative Feature at South by Southwest in 2010. So this is a huge, huge splash for someone's first feature. And the success of Tiny Furniture led Lena to HBO, where she signed what's called a blind script deal. And a blind script deal means that the studio just wants to work with you. They don't have a specific script or idea in mind. They just want to be in the Rachel Brodsky business. So they sign a contract with you.
Go nuts. Just go nuts.
Go HBO, we're ready. And this is like, rather than the studio buying a script that you've already written.
Yeah, yeah. They just like you.
Yeah. So Lena was profiled by David Carr in the New York Times as a part of the Tiny Furniture press parade. And David Carr wound up introducing Lena to then super producer Judd Apatow. And Lena and Jenny Connor, the showrunner of Girls, asked Judd if he wanted to be a part of it. And Judd was, quote, thrilled to jump in. We talk a lot about privilege and nepotism babies on this show, and it's very much in the cultural zeitgeist now, but I think it's important to understand the context of Lena's rise to stardom in particular. I am not for a moment insinuating that she didn't work hard. However, whether some strings got pulled or just like a great deal of luck, things like a casual introduction to Judd Apatow, who wants to produce your show, is exceedingly rare.
I have theories. I have theories because I don't know to what extent you have followed Lena Dunham's post-Girls work.
I have.
Okay. Is it fair to say that little of it has maybe risen to quite the same degree of success as Girls?
I think, completely fair to say.
Okay. So my theory is that Girls was, I think, more of a collaborative writing process than the rest of Lena's work.
I think that's probably right. And famously, Judd Apatow takes like a really close, has like very close oversight over the things he produces. And like he did something similar with Bridesmaids, which was famously written in 3 days by Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo. And he came in and the first draft took 3 days and then the second draft took 4 months.
Okay. Okay. So I've always kind of thought that Girls versus Post Girls suffered a little bit of a George Lucas problem.
Sure.
I'm just going off of vibes here. I don't have anything to prove my thesis other than the vibes, but I learned this courtesy of an ex who was obsessed with Star Wars, as you film people tend to be. And I learned that George Lucas had like full say over all three prequels.
The prequels, yes.
And they sucked because no one told him no.
Well, I have so many things that we could talk about offline.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far away from the subject of our episode today. But that's kind of what like my issue and feeling about Lena Dunham post Girls is that Girls was such a splash and so successful and polarizing that probably nobody told her no or tells her no very much since then.
And it's tough when you start to believe your own hype, right? Which is what happened to George Lucas, right? He started to believe that he was the genius.
Yeah. And I think Lena would probably be the first person to say, I don't believe my hype at all. I actually like hate myself. There are different kinds of believing your own hype, I think.
It's true. And the poster for Lena's film, Tiny Furniture, features Lena's face and in big block millennial pastel letters reads, Aura would like you to know that she's having a very, very hard time. And Girls is no different, right? Lena this time is playing Hannah Horvath. She would still like you to know that she's having a very, very hard time. In the pilot, she gets cut off by her wealthy professor parents.
I don't think they're wealthy, though. Just
they're
to
not
jump
wealthy.
They're
not wealthy.
Yeah.
The mother who's from Freaks and Geeks, another Judd Apatow show, says that she wants a vacation house. So that's why so maybe not wealthy. But
they
don't want to pay.
They're definitely privileged. They're definitely privileged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Enough,
for sure.
Yeah.
She loses her unpaid internship for asking to be paid. She fucks an absolutely feral Adam Driver and drinks enough opium tea to maybe have a panic attack. And now she'll have to fend for herself in New York with only the help of her best friends. Girls draws a lot from Sex and the City, at times embracing the sameness of the HBO comedy drama that premiered 14 years before Girls did, and sometimes subverting it. Zsozsa Mamet's character Shoshana, which also happens to be my mother's name, has a Sex and the City poster on her wall. And much like she tries to diagnose her cousin Jessa, played by Jemima Kirk, as part Carrie and part Samantha, the four girls in Girls fit the classic millennial archetypes.
Okay, I love this.
You ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
The girl boss.
Marnie,
right? Played by Allison Williams. The cringe queen.
Zsozsa Mamet.
I would also have accepted the virgin who can't drive. The Hot Mess Express, Hannah Horvath herself, and the British one.
That's just her personality British.
Is being British. Each of them has struggles with what it means to be a 20-something in New York in 2012. Hannah has an on-again, off-again boyfriend, Adam, played by Adam Driver, who seems obsessed with subjugating her during sex to the point that in the first three episodes, he refers to her as a slave twice and makes her role play mid-coitus as a prostitute who is very disappointing to her parents. But Hannah,
it's so funny. It's so funny. I know you don't like it, but it is so funny. I don't like it. And
I know you. Yeah.
And I know the plots are so ridiculous and everything they do is so ridiculous, but it's so funny.
I think the writing is hysterical.
Yeah.
So this comes to like my central question of the episode, which is who is in on the joke of Girls? So at some point in episode two, while getting an STD test, Hannah admits that she wishes that she had HIV because then her boyfriend would text her back and her parents would pay for her apartment. Like I understand that that's got to be played for laughs, right? No human is that crazy.
That's why I think it's satire.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
But does that extend all the way to, like, does Lena Dunham and does Hannah Horvath, well, sorry, does Lena Dunham know that Hannah Horvath sucks?
I don't know. I don't know if Hannah sucks. I don't think she sucks. I think she makes weird decisions, but I don't think she sucks. I think the idea that she sucks is a little misogynistic.
Lay it on me.
I think it is. I think we excuse a lot of really poor behavior from guys and call it misunderstood or they're just troubled or whatever. And
quirky.
And yeah, she definitely makes horrible decisions and she's not the best person, but sucks. I would not say that she sucks.
I'm of the opinion that everyone on this show sucks, except maybe Ray.
Have I met Ray?
Ray is, but Ray is perfect.
But Ray is also, he's also got like 10 years on all of them. So he's learned a little bit. He's a little bit more mature. I mean, he's a still kind of a man boy because he's hanging out with a bunch of people 10 years his junior all the time.
I mean, is it not so weird? He's like so much older. You don't even realize at the time. You're like, wait, mm-hmm. I thought you were their age.
But he has a certain wisdom that he never hesitates.
Is this Alex Karpovsky's character?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Who's in Tiny Furniture?
Yes, as a love interest.
So is Jessa. In Tiny Furniture as well.
Yes.
I also like don't think that I will kind of split the difference. And I really think that everybody kind of sucks to an extent and that they are all drowning in narcissism.
Yes.
However, they are also very human. And I think that's why this show resonated so much, at least for a certain slice of the population. I'm not going to say it resonated for everybody because that was a huge problem on Girls that they heard about, the producers and the actors heard about from the very beginning, that the show is only showing you like just white young people. And after that, like every black person on the show felt like a prop.
Yeah.
But that, and so it's an imperfect experience. However, I do think that there is a lot of overlap in the ratio of Lena Dunham and Hannah Horvath. I think that Hannah is like an emphasized over the top version.
Right, right.
Which is why I'm unclear on how self-aware Lena is about Hannah's flaws or foibles or quirks. But this leads us to episode 3. Hannah discovers that she has HPV after Adam claims to have been tested and given the all clear. Hannah contacts her old boyfriend Elijah, played by Book of Mormon's Andrew Rannells, and accuses him of giving it to her. Meanwhile, Marnie goes to an art opening and after some extremely inappropriate behavior by her boss, has a little evening adventure with an artist played by Short King Jorma Taccone from Lonely Island. Marnie refuses to kiss the artist, Booth, and after he says something lewd to her about fucking her like a man, she's so turned on that she runs back to the art gallery to masturbate in the bathroom.
He knows how to do things.
Sorry, the sexual tension in that scene, like, I'm gagged every time. Like, I'm sorry, I don't care. Like, I watch it, I'm like, because continue.
Well, I mean, when you were that age, if someone was like 10 years older and seemed really successful to you.
And just a little bit dangerous.
They could get away with saying something. I mean, now, like, if I'm in my 30s and I would be like, fuck you, you know, get over yourself. But like when I was 23 or 24, that's a very relatable feeling. But yeah, meeting someone of that seeming stature, even though they probably suck, as she finds out later.
I would love to discuss and unpack the portrayal of dudes, just like shit ass dudes in this show after we talk about the scene. So meanwhile, Jessa nearly fucks the father of the girl she babysits, but the poor four-year-old wakes up and cock blocks the whole affair. Hannah meets up with Elijah to discover, gasp, he's gay, and spirals wondering that means for her.
That is one of the best scenes. I rewatched it today, and that scene, first of all, if you watch the entire show of Girls, the foreshadowing in that scene is so fucking perfect. And just like, the insults, like the way that, oh my God, like Hannah and Elijah are like a match made in like a like heaven. Like it works so well.
I really love Andrew Rannells and I love his performance.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe this is, so when I say Hannah sucks, this is what kind of what I'm talking about, where she chooses to make his coming out about her and not just like, I have HPV and you gave it to me, but like, what does this mean about me? Do I look like a man? Is that why you fucked me? And that to me is a reaction that might even have been outdated for millennials, but is definitely outdated for anyone younger than we are who like wouldn't have that kind of visceral,
right?
Selfish.
But I think what's kind of amazing about that scene is how honest it is. Sure. Like, of course, Lena Dunham's going to sit there and think like, oh my God, I dated someone who's now telling me he's gay. Like, it's just like the natural human experience almost to be narcissistic. I mean, everyone's narcissistic to an extent, and she's not being homophobic. She's just sitting there like trying to process it and take it all right in. And honestly, the way she does it is fucking hysterical.
That scene is one of my favorites. And Aviv, I don't know if you realize this, but Hannah's father does in fact turn out to be gay.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Good. I noticed his ear stud in the first scene. I was like, there's something up with that. They hit that with one too many close-ups.
By the way, Hannah's mother, when her father comes out, has a very similar reaction to Hannah. So it's really, that episode in particular is so, and it's so funny. I went on the HBO Girls Rewatch podcast to talk about that very episode, which is so funny.
Interesting.
So I was gonna apologize up top that we are not the HBO or the Girls Rewatch podcast, which I watch on TikTok more than listen to. But I was gonna say that I really enjoy that the Girls Rewatch podcast in particular, because I can tell that it's a generation slightly younger, and it's right. Like they are taking in this stuff and like recontextualizing it. It's very recent history. And I just really, right. I get a kick out of seeing the material redigested by people who are kind of in that girl's age now.
Our episode concludes with Hannah working through her own pity party, where else but on Twitter. And after deleting a series of tweets, settles
it's
on...
It's okay to have a pity party every now and then.
I'm not anti... Oh, I have had plenty of pity parties in my day. And by in my day, I mean today. After deleting a series of tweets, she settles on the half cringy, half cryptic, all adventurous women do. And yes, then she dances.
RIP cryptic status updates that no longer exist. We can't do that anymore.
Can't do that anymore. It used to be called vague booking.
I don't think that is that cringy. I actually thought really? It was really empowering, honestly, and really sweet and like really uplifting to a lot of women who probably feel really anxious about having an STD or HPV, you know? Like, fuck yeah, all adventurous women do. It's awesome. Well, HPV isn't awesome, but you know.
Yeah, right. It's in reference to her having because Jessa says all adventurous women do.
Well, she's sitting with Shoshana on the couch, and Shoshana, it's the show is so funny. Shoshana's watching the show Baggage. And Shoshana's like, you've never seen Baggage. And she's like, no, I haven't. And Shoshana's like, okay, what would your baggage be? And Lena Dunham's like, da-da-da-da-da, and I have HPV.
Right.
And she is so down on herself. And Shoshana's like, oh, what? It's fine. Jessa has that too. She says all adventurous women do. So I don't think it's cringy. I think it's almost like, I don't know. It's something positive about something not positive that, right. I mean, why not? You can't change it. It's there. Yeah. So fuck yeah, all adventurous women do.
Yeah. I have a not dissimilar story actually of my own. Then I debated whether or not I was going to share. But when I was in college, I think I was like 19, and this is way too TMI, so I apologize. But
no,
it's where we're at. That's the show, and that's it's girls. I was as inexperienced as they come, and I hadn't really had a real boyfriend before. But I go to the doctor, and they tell me that, hey, you have HPV. And this was so new. Like, we were just kind of finding out what HPV even was, right? Like, because this was 2006. And it took a little while because I was like, but how can I? I don't understand. And I, after some like research, and then I realized, okay, so like everybody has this.
Right.
Like, and then guess what? Like 7 years later, it was gone. Because it's got this turnover.
It's got a shelf life.
It's like, you know how they say that your cells turn over every 7 years or something? It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Where so now, like, it was like I went through a long period of time where they were telling me, oh, you still got it. And then one day it was like, you're all good. And now, but when this show was filmed, though, I think HPV was still a little misunderstood.
Right.
Of course. Yeah.
I think that is that is to me what plays into a little bit of the cringe factor, because through a 2024 lens, this seems like a very small deal, and I understand that it's a very, very big deal to Hannah and to basically everyone else.
It was a really big deal to me too at the time. I was kind of like, but I've never done anything.
And I think the episode kind of highlights what it means to woman when she tells Elijah, well, Adam got tested and he doesn't have it. And Elijah goes, well, there's no test for men, so what are you talking about? And I think that's why the term all adventurous women do just kind of like really struck a chord. And I honestly think this episode has a lot to do with the way we now view what HPV means and what it is. Like, this episode, when it came out, was such a big deal. Like, I remember seeing this everywhere, and I was 11.
After hitting tweet, Hannah dances to Robin's Dancing on My Own with Marnie, who has hopefully washed her hands before leaving the art gallery. Let's take a quick listen to the scene.
I wanted to kind of turn the floor over to Jake for a second and ask you about your relationship to the song. Like, were you a fan of Robin? Did this introduce you to Robin?
This did introduce me to Robin, and now I'm a very big fan of Robin. I think she's amazing. And Call Your Girlfriend is one of my favorite songs ever. Obviously, Dancing on My Own is fucking fantastic. But can I say why I think this song is used in such a smart way?
Please, yeah.
This is the perfect time for it.
So I think, obviously, the scene utilizes, like, the rule of threes really, really well. So Lena Dunham is tweeting, and her first tweet is something super sad and mopey. Second tweet, something super sad and mopey. Right before she tweets the third tweet, the song changes from what is a really sad, just, like, stereotypically really depressing song to Dancing on My Own, which, if you know the lyrics, you know is a really, really, really sad song disguised as a pop song, and kind of signifies taking what life kind of throws at you and saying the only thing you can kind of control is your reaction to that. And so then Dancing on My Own plays, and she completely changes the narrative of her tweets. And the third tweet is all adventurous women do. And then Marnie gets back, and they just have this moment of like pure euphoria that's like arisen out of such sadness. Whether people think they're being dramatic or not, it's arisen out of Hannah being really, really sad. Like, she, you know, and then this song plays, which is just about exactly that. And like, the euphoria of the song matches so well with the euphoria that you can tell that Marnie and Hannah are obviously like pushing themselves to feel. And it's a really, really beautiful scene.
I think that that's spot on. And you can even, there's like textual evidence of that where she says, oh, Elijah's gay. And they're like, Elijah's gay. And she has just such a
marked. He seemed gay.
Right. He seemed gay. And they have such a different reaction than what Hannah had in the restaurant. And so it is just about like choosing your own reaction to the bad news, the tragedy that comes your way, whatever that might look like.
I also like this scene in particular. I kind of see it now, having watched the whole series. I feel like this, like when they hug each other and they're dancing together, and for a minute it's almost like they're back in college.
Yes. Oh, yes.
But I almost feel like this is kind of like the point where their friendship starts to, like, after this, I feel like their friendship starts to diverge and change, and like they're, as they keep living together, but it's not really the same, like it, this is kind of the last time that they're kind of 100% in sync with each other. Not to like pun our own show.
That's the name of our show.
Yeah. But there's a lot of discussion in your 20s and 30s about how your friendships change, people's lives move in different directions. But just for this moment, Hannah's and Marnie's lives are in the same place. And it's almost like paying homage to that almost being like the last hurrah for their friendship.
Right. And it feels like a college dorm.
And you, if you even do the math, Hannah and Marnie have been out of college for 2 years because Betsy Ann Baker says we've been paying your rent for 2 years. And the song is 2 years old. So this very well could have been a song that they were dancing to in their dorms. Senior year of college, where they're clasping hands and promising to be friends forever. Feels very much like the top of a roller coaster where everyone feels weightless for a minute.
Yeah,
exactly. Which is a really, really nice piece of filmmaking. And that's really, really nice piece of filmmaking.
Yeah. I actually think of this song, Dancing on My Own, as kind of a Silver Lake happy, sad foot.
Oh, happy foot, sad foot.
Happy foot, sad foot.
Jake, are you in LA?
I am in LA.
Do you know the happy foot, sad foot?
I don't. And I would love, I'm very curious. I was like, what is that?
In Silver Lake on Sunset Boulevard, there was a foot reflexology place. I don't know what it was called, but it had a big, like huge, like 10-foot tall rotating sign. And on one side was a happy foot that had visited the reflexology place. And on the other, there was a sad foot, which didn't.
That's amazing.
Visit the reflexology place.
Yeah. So the reflexology place is actually just down the street from our apartment building, Aviv. But the sign is no longer, I think, is it Ad Hoc or it's that store?
EK. EQ.
EQ. EQ. Yeah. Thank you. The great.
It's in like a punk rock t-shirt store now. They stole it.
They have it now. But I think of dancing on, well, so I should back up and say that Swedish pop music has been like the backbone to my life. Music. Yeah.
Max Martin, like, hello.
Max Martin, like, pop genius.
ABBA.
ABBA, yeah.
It goes
one of my everyone. Top five bands of all time.
And if I was very, not to pull the music nerd thing and be like, well, I used to listen to Robin back, you know, when she, like, in the mid '90s. Right. But I did actually have the her "Robin Is Here" album when I was in middle school, and my friends and I made up like a whole dance to one of the songs on it, and I was just kind of obsessed with Robin from the get go, and then she makes this. She was always round. She never disappeared, but she kind of makes a splashback in America with the Body Talk Part 1 album, which was actually her fifth album, which came out in April 2010. And it's this leading with this bittersweet electropop gem. And it's, I think, to this day, probably her best known hit, along with Hang With Me and Call Your Girlfriend. And Call Your Girlfriend has that just one of the best music videos.
That song rips. That song's so good.
That song, Fox.
Yeah. And this song and album actually were, it sounds like Robin was always a really big fan of like club culture, but didn't see club culture as being something she could lead into in the mainstream like pop music sense until 2010. And for this, I mean, this song, it's pretty straightforward. It was actually written in the wake of her thinking about leaving, or I think it was like the process of leaving a relationship she was in with Swedish MMA fighter and contemporary visual artist Olof Inger.
Wow.
So combine the actual bittersweet mood that Robin herself was experiencing with the premise of watching an ex on the floor at the end of the night, making out with someone else, probably he can't see you. And she's like thinking about confronting him, but opts not to because he's busy. But there's really nothing she can do about this. Kind of like Jake was saying, all you can really do in this situation is just like whatever you
dance
choose
on your
to do.
Own. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's exactly what Hannah does until yes. Marty joins her.
And it's the happy foot, sad foot, right? It's the happy beat and the sad lyrics.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Which is like,
yeah, yeah.
That, in my opinion, like that to me is a perfect, that's what makes a pop song perfect.
You know what I mean? Totally.
When you're like, when you are singing and you're like, wait, what's this about? And it's like so intensely depressing, like kind of like Antihero by Taylor Swift, right? Because mm-hmm. she's talking about how much she hates herself. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, you're like dancing all at the same time. Taylor Swift is so good at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Taylor Swift is bananas with a happy, euphoric melody with like a bittersweet minor key. Like undertone.
Right.
I got lost in the moment for a minute. I had to.
Yeah. She transported herself.
I did. I saw through space and time. And there was in 2020, BBC ran, I guess you could call it an oral history, but it's not quite structured that way. But writer Stephen Holden got the whole story behind Dancing on My Own, along with quotes from Robin and Lena Dunham. So Holden writes about how Dancing on My Own was Robin's first new music in years since With Every Heartbeat, and that came out around like 2007. And Robin at the time told Radio One, so I'm not sure if she is like from a previous interview done through BBC, but anyway, it's on their website. And Robin is quoted as saying, I knew I wanted to make a song called Dancing on My Own. I just didn't know what it was going to be about. So she had the name of the song.
That's super interesting.
She even sat down to write it.
Some of the best pieces of art are made that way.
But it also seems like she had the emotion too, right? Mm-hmm. The emotion yeah. and the title, and then mm-hmm. was like, I have to figure out how to put this into the scheme of this yes. this backbone.
So she had an idea of a chorus. That's pretty much where she started out from, along with the name and the feeling. And then she collaborated with a Swedish producer, Patrick Berger, with whom she had collaborated on her previous album. And Patrick is quoted as talking about the chorus and how, quote, everything fell into place and it felt like it was writing itself. This is one of those songs that just spills out of you. And he said, every single word needed to feel right. His favorite lyric is, quote, I know where you're at. I bet she's around, which he feels represents the, quote, self-destructive part of you when we know we shouldn't go there. It's like scratching a wound.
Which is also Hannah, right? Because Hannah knows that she should dump Adam or stop going over to Adam's because he sucks and is like never going to treat her like she deserves to be treated. Yes. And yet she can't stop scratching at that wound.
But we all had an Adam is I think like the,
oh yeah.
I think that was the, it doesn't really matter the particulars of how she handled that situation and how Adam was. It was just that this scenario, this coupling was so triggering because everyone had someone that they kind of just hoped would ask them to stay.
Yeah.
Even if knew that they probably wouldn't. And then later in the season, they actually do formally become like boyfriend and girlfriend and whatever. Like she uses her words and tells him what she wants. And
good for Anna.
And then they get together, but it's kind of like one of those, she's projecting her idea of him and then he turns out to be his own person.
Yeah, which is what Marnie's boyfriend is doing to her, right?
Just you wait. I know you won't watch the rest
yeah.
of the
film. I might like it.
I think you should. Just watch it with Leanne.
There is a capsule episode with Allison Williams, and it is top three in the show. One of the best. It's called Panic in yeah. Central Park. And the sinks in that episode are also good. They do a Deja Load song, and it's
my wrap up. I think might redeem my girls. I think we might find some common ground during my wrap up, Jake.
I hope, Aviv.
I think you should, if nothing else, just watch the whole show. It's a quick watch,
and yeah. It's really quick.
Because the first season, especially the first like five episodes, are so densely girls mm-hmm. in probably some of its most frustrating at times ways, and then it the show really does grow into itself.
The episodes are pretty breezy. Like I was very kind of like each of the three episodes had like, well, the first two episodes had this like very nice cliffhanger. The first episode ends where she wakes up in her parents' hotel room after they've left, and the second one is like mid gynecological exam right after she's talking about how much she wishes that she had HIV. And both of those are like great cliffhangers to make me want to watch another episode. So I might.
You should.
It's really, I'm telling you, it's really watching them grow and like figure shit out is, and also this music in the show and the use of music is so, I mean, Rachel, you watched the whole show, right?
I've rewatched it multiple times. Yeah.
Do you remember when Shoshana's in Tokyo and they play Past Life by Borns?
Yes. I love that needle drop.
Oh, so good. And then in Goodbye Tour at the end of season six, when they do Banks's Crowded Places, like it is so fantastic.
Yeah. The Tokyo episodes are stunning.
Stunning.
Yeah. Watching how there's a lot of start and stop. And it honestly, like even thinking about girls, because I'm around their age, I wasn't in Tokyo, but it's triggering and it's like smelling like a shirt or something that I used to wear 10 years ago.
And this is
like
how I feel too.
Remembering how I felt at that time in my life. And so if the show achieves nothing else, it definitely achieves the capturing a time and a place.
And I think the reason it struck a chord with me so intensely is because I am the exact age that the show picks up at. So like watching that being 2 years out of college is just, I also, I don't know, there's a lot of factors about the show that I think it's one of the first representations of OCD we see on like real OCD we see on, and I struggle with that OCD, not like let's make everything neat OCD, like the even Hannah, OCD Hannah has. So the whole show is like an emotional roller coaster for me. And it's just also, I don't know, just means a lot to me.
Absolutely. Well, not that I think anyone needs to compare girls to Sex and the City anymore, because that's been done to death. But that is kind of how I felt rewatching Sex and the City in my 30s. Mm-hmm. And I will definitely say these women are like, I don't want to say like messes, because I think that is misogynistic for sure. But I felt like these women in their 30s might have learned more in their 20s about dating and advocating for yourself as 30-something women. And I think that was like kind of a disconnect for me. But I really enjoyed some of the topics like going to people's baby showers and not having a baby yourself, and feeling like the loss of a friendship when someone leaves a city for the suburbs, and then like lots of other things like being sexually harassed in a closet, but not literally, but like handling sexual harassment from a boss figure. I could go on and on, but so it's interesting to get the perspective of somebody who is now in their mid-20s and like, what do you relate to and what feels a little outdated? I mean, actually, just to pick your brain for a second, what does do you, if anything, feel outdated?
From girls?
Yeah.
Just a lot of the millennial core. Like, you know, I spoke about this before, but like the term hipster. You know, like, like we don't use that word anymore. Like,
no, we don't. Thank God.
Like, you know, like no one's really hipster anymore. Like, I don't know. I gotta,
because of monoculture.
Right. Like I got to sit down and really rewatch it to be like, okay, this feels outdated. But like a lot of it. But I think what makes girls stand the test of time, which I do think it has, is that the feelings that these characters have and the way they act on their feelings, like, that's timeless, right? Like human behavior is timeless. It's our exterior that's constantly changing. So while our environments constantly change, the way these characters act so honestly, whether that be in a good way or a bad way, I think a lot of people can relate to. And I think that's why it stands the test of time.
I completely agree with that, especially in the relationship between Hannah and Adam, where it is this kind of this gauntlet that every young 20 something has to go through of like being in a quasi in a situationship, which that word didn't exist back then, with someone who they knew was bad for them, but they couldn't stay away from. Like as soon as that dynamic hit the screen, I was like, oh, like stepped into a time machine. Like, oh man, this feels so authentic to what my experience was, as well as probably so many others.
As someone who got called a hipster a lot, I am extremely happy that hipster no longer exists. I mean, what gave it away?
I mean, I'm trying to think about like what the, but obviously like all these terms get replaced. So I'm trying to like mm-hmm. think like what's the current term?
Indie sleaze.
Yes. Indie. Like, yeah.
Indie.
Yeah. Indie sleaze. We didn't.
This is the original indie sleaze.
That wasn't a thing. I mean, now, of course, I do love that phrase, by the way, because it so captures like the messiness, literally, because it was messy.
Right.
And drunk and caffeinated, usually at the same time. A lot of caffeinated drunkness.
Yes, that's true. I think that's called cocaine.
Yeah, I wouldn't
Speaking
know.
Of, there is a great episode of Girls in which Lena does cocaine, and it is, oh my God, and they have the best sync to I Love It by Icona Pop.
Yeah, and that is a good sync.
So amazing. Oh my God, Aviv, I'm begging you to watch this show.
I will, like, for you, Jake, I will. I
like,
promise.
Like, really, there are certain episodes that just make you, I know you have your qualms about how much Lena Dunham did, but there are episodes that you can tell she leads like American Bitch. Do you remember that episode?
Like,
oh my God,
I don't want to spoil the ending. I don't want to spoil the ending of my little rant, but yes, I promise you I will continue watching Girls. We will have, you and I will have a weekly check-in.
Yeah,
I will email you.
I will mediate it. Yeah. I'll mediate the check-in. But let me shoehorn some more fun facts.
Yeah, how did this wind up in the show in the first place?
Well, first I want to say that Robin has Robin has herself described Dancing on My Own as a mixture of many different worlds, including Prince songs, 80s rock ballads, and queer electronica.
Oh man, I hear the Prince in it. Like, now that you said it, I hear the Prince in it too.
And I want to go down a bit. I'm going to scroll down my little handy little document and quote from Manish Raval, the lead music supervisor, who in 2016 was reflecting on this musical moment in Girls. So he tells Vulture in 2016, ahead of the show's final season, that this will go down as the definitive musical moment of Girls. Seeing that for the first time in the editing room was like, oh shit, this will be like nothing else I've seen or worked on before. I had the same reaction that fans had when they saw it for the first time. Lena wanted that song. She wanted to end the episode with Hannah and Marnie dancing to it. It was one of the first things that she knew ahead of time. And for me, I just wanted to make sure that I got it for her. So it's cool. There's some synchronicity there, where Robin knew that she had this kernel of an idea for a song and what it was called, and Lena Dunham knew prior to even, I think, because this is like the third episode, so she knew that she wanted, no matter what, she wants this song in the show. And I personally think that speaks to this song's generational defining quality.
Right.
And I will say that this is such a good sync that no one is talking about a similarly styled sync in the first episode, which is MGMT's Time to Pretend.
Oh, yeah.
It's like functions in sort of a similar way in the episode. And I'm like, oh, this is like a fine musical moment. And then it's sort of like elevated upon in this third episode, which the first three episodes function as its own mini Hannah movie too, right? The third episode is the one that doesn't end on this cliffhanger. And so it feels like a culmination of all the things we've seen Hannah go through in this first 90 minutes of the show.
Yeah, it's probably like the first three episodes that they handed over to critics.
And this was part of like the way that they made especially shows for streaming at the time, and obviously this wasn't streaming, was that instead of going been producing just a pilot, Netflix, when they started doing original content like this same year, would produce the first three episodes of a show instead of just one. And this has carried over to this day that like the streamers do not just a pilot, they go straight to series or straight to three episodes.
I was just thinking about how Lena was, this was when I read about what the music selection process was like on Girls, it sounds highly collaborative. And Manish in Vox in 2017, so there was a ton of press like leading up to the final season of Girls, which you both probably remember. And Manish said to Vox that he kind of described the overall music sync process. And he said, anytime we're supplied a scene where we have to find music for it, the first thing that we like to do is that we go to this bag of tricks that we've set aside. These are things that we've had emotional responses to. So let's see if any of these work in this scene. Now, if we can't find anything there, then we do the scoring, we do the scouring of trying to find something similar, or maybe they have an idea that they've given us a direction for, or it's something so wildly different than what our initial response is. And then he says, we always felt like Dunham was the final say on Girls in terms of music selection. And then over the years of getting to know her, we wanted to find out what her personal taste was. The way that we operated was that we had a very fluid musical relationship. Even when we stopped working on a particular season and you go on hiatus, we never stopped working with each other. We just had this year-round continuous musical friendship.
I think that speaks to something that we talked about in the beginning of the episode, which is like the music, especially with a TV show, helps fill out the world in a way that just conversing in words doesn't, you know, like you communicate in music.
Well, you mentioned something that I don't want to forget about, Aviv. You mentioned A Time to Pretend by MGMT, and yes. No hate to MGMT.
All however, hate to MGMT. MGMT, you can speak ill of them if
MGMT
you want.
MGMT does feel a bit more locked in a certain year, like, for example, it's a placement in Saltburn, and Saltburn is like a slice of 2006, 2007. And I think a lot of the songs, like some of the songs you haven't even really thought about, or if you have, then it's to think of 2006, 2007, that time. I think Robin and Dancing on My Own, and certainly the entire Body Talk Part One album, it could really have come out at any time and would be a hit.
Because it's good pop music, and good pop music like stands the test of time.
Timeless. And it's interesting because I wonder if they must have, right? This is what music supervisors do, but they must have had a sense that the song is timeless versus MGMT, which had kind of a shelf life. I always think of MGMT as opening the 2007 or 8 film about the MIT students that go to like Hustle Las Vegas with Jim Sturgis and Kevin Spacey. It's like the opening song in that movie.
Oh my God. Yes. What movie is that again? You just unlocked the crazy memory.
Is that the one with Jesse Eisenberg? Or
yes.
No.
Yes.
Is Jesse Eisenberg in it?
No.
No.
What you're talking about is The Social Network.
No. There's some movie where he goes to like do Vegas shit or magic stuff.
Yeah. Oh, no. That's Now You See Me. Which I have seen. It's the book is called Bringing Down 21. The House.
21.
21 is the name of the movie.
Oh, can't
imagine why I forgot the name of that movie. but speaking of this kind of timelessness versus very kind of shelf stable sort of this is from this moment. This is kind of how I came to appraise Girls after watching the first three episodes. I recently went to a revival screening of The Wedding Singer.
Nice.
And right.
Classic.
Wedding Singer rules.
It does rule.
The Wedding Singer was made in 1998, but it takes place in 1995, which is a 13-year difference between creation and appreciation, which is roughly the same distance between now and the pilot of Girls, right? When I am appreciating the pilot of Girls for the first time. And I think this series and these episodes provide as much of a time capsule to the 2010s, art, fashion, stereotypes of men and women, like Jake was talking about, the way people talk, especially Shoshana, the music.
Yeah, and instead of a Bushwick party, it would be a Ridgewood party today.
Today, right. And my best friend lives in Ridgewood. And as The Wedding Singer does to 1985. But that's not an actually fair comparison, because the Adam Sandler movie was created in 98 looking back and lampooning the past. The jokes are on purpose. And it took me until the combination of Hannah in the job interview with Mike Birbiglia and then the STD scene, or the STD test scene, to realize that Hannah is, I think, in on the joke of her. I'm not calling her character a joke, but I think Hannah and Lena Dunham is in on the joke. And
well, I think if you watch the commentary, like there are those little those videos at the end of each episode where Lena is talking about her intentions. Yeah, the like behind the scenes, and they're kind of narrating and like doing a little like under the hood look at what the characters were thinking and what their like motivations are. And Lena's those vignettes are very articulate. And Lena, I think, was always aware. However, I don't think she's always been aware in her own life. I think she has a really good like long term awareness. I'm just making this up right now.
I think you're right.
I think maybe in the moment there's a lack of filter, and that's what the character shows too. But then she is like really capable of kind of like watching and adapting.
But I think she is self-aware, right? The show's labeled a half-hour comedy, so she's poking fun. She wants you to laugh. It's funny.
Yeah.
You know? Like, she's making a half hour comedy. Of course she's aware. She's too aware. That's the whole point of that.
Too aware. Yeah.
We don't want to give her credit for seeing the attributes of her generation. And I think that this is not just Lena, but Lena and the showrunner and the producers and general, like kind of everybody in the creative team, of seeing the caricatures of millennials, the like heckin doggo, but first coffee, gaslight, gatekeep, girl boss people, and poking fun at them while they're still in there. And what unlocked this for me and unlocked a different appreciation for girls for me is not the comparison to Sex and the City, which I think is drawn because it's like four women and four women, and you can, that could be where it begins and ends. But Hannah might be the millennial Larry David, right? This might be a 20 something Curb Your Enthusiasm where, yeah, Hannah is Lena Dunham. Lena Dunham is Hannah, and she is kind of acting selfishly, which Lena might do in real life, but there is this awareness and this ability to poke fun at the situation she gets herself in, and both things can be true at the same time, just like it is with all of Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I want to interject one final thought there, is that I want to think of her as a writer, and writers think of themselves as being super self-aware. Mm-hmm. But I think that Hannah, the character, who is a writer and also a very young writer, is self-aware, but she may not be as aware of herself as she thinks she is. And that's where she often falls in to society's the sort of social awkwardness cracks of society. I'm sorry, yeah. I'm just spitting this out loud. If I were writing it, I would say it completely differently.
No, I think that that's right. And there's so many different layers of self-awareness. Even the moments of Hannah's biggest narcissism are because of how aware she is that she doesn't fit in with these like very good-looking TV actor types, right? Hot, not an ounce of body fat, right? Where like Adam Driver asks her to gather his fat just as like his own narcissism.
That part is crazy. That skin, Adam. Like, yeah. So funny.
And this brings me to your TikTok, Jake. On Christmas Eve of this past year, you posted a TikTok of you singing Dancing on My Own with the caption that just read Season 1, Episode 3. And you had mentioned that this is like a very pivotal part of your girls watching upbringing, and girls is a very pivotal part of your kind of media, what you like it, your media diet, right? Yeah. As a member of Gen Z, as a youngster.
Yes, please speak for your entire generation.
Yeah, as the voice of your generation.
Or a generation.
What is your take on girls' legacy in the war between that these things are completely universal and everyone has an Adam, everyone has an Elijah, everyone has a best friend named like Marnie.
Until you don't.
Versus like, we are aware that we are being cringe, and to be cringe is to be free, but we know that we're acting a little foolishly, and we know that future generations will laugh at us just like the way that we laughed at our parents' generations for saying totally radical, dude.
I mean, I think why the girls are so good is because the situations and the environment may change, as we often see it has. But if you watch the whole show and you really see, you can see the characters wear their feelings on their sleeves. Maybe not Shoshana at first, even though you kind of think she does, she doesn't. And I think it's kind of timeless. The way that they're feeling and the way that they're acting, people are never going to stop feeling that way about similar situations. I just, for me watching it, the reason I captioned the TikTok that was just because it reminded me of how good that song was. And I was just the only thing I was listening to all day. And so I was just telling people like, this is the book, I guess, why I'm listening to the song. But there's a lot of moments in Girls that like, I'm like, okay, well, that hasn't exactly happened to me, but I resonate weirdly. God, she's so horrible. And then you like start to like think about yourself. You're like,
have I done that?
You're like, fuck, have I done that? I don't know. I just think it's a really timeless show. There's factors of it that obviously are not timeless, right? Like,
yeah,
it should have been way more diverse, et cetera, et cetera. But the feelings that these characters have and the way they play out on screen stand the test of time almost.
The girls end up in such a different place with each other than they are at the beginning. I think that was my biggest takeaway. Just like living through my 20s is like who was in your life and how that changes and why.
This also might be me being too self-aware of like being the part of the older generation that is now okay to be made fun of, right? If TikTok is to be believed, millennials can be the brunt of jokes for all of the cringy shit that we did when we were in our 20s, which is like fair game, right? Everyone does it. Everyone is the victim and everyone is the perpetrator of stuff like that. And so I guess my question is, how easy is it for you as someone young to look past like the chunky belts and the thin scarves and the way that Shoshana speaks, which feels very much like a caricature of a millennial?
I don't know. I mean, I think Shoshana has said I still speak like that sometimes. Like, yeah, sure. Like, it's what I'm saying is like Shoshana like will say things, but you just need to fill in the blanks almost. So she's recommending a show or this, fill in the blanks to something that is today, and it holds the same weight. You know what I mean?
The book that she recommends, which is like how to talk to women for women,
right,
or how to talk to ladies for ladies, which is like a fun scene because Jessa is like, we're not ladies, we're girls.
Well, isn't that supposed to be like a take on, or like a riff on He's Just Not That Into You?
You're right, exactly.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is it's pretty easy to look past. I don't really mind it. It's more of just like, I think that's a testament to the substance of the show and like the way that they act and how funny they are. Cause I'm not like, God, like, what is she wearing? Cause like, what am I wearing? You know what I mean? Like 10 years, someone's probably gonna say the same shit about me.
Oh, they will. You think everyone thinks they're safe and they're not.
No one's safe. As Taylor Swift once said, you will always look back on your life and you will cringe. And that's just part of
I think it's that much easier to cringe at millennials because the internet moves at a warp speed.
Oh, so
right. More
so
and more and more and more. And everything that we did is documented that our younger friends can see. And we're cringing just as much as our younger friends.
Clearly
are, if not more. That's why I can't ever sign into Facebook anymore. Well, A, because I hate it, but B, because it reminds me of some dumb shit I said in 2011.
And to me, and this may
thought
have
it was
been
so profound.
To this may have been a problem of the marketing of the film, or the marketing of the show, or how I perceived it. But when Hannah says, "I think I might be the voice of my generation, or a voice of a generation," I should have picked up like, "Oh, this is all a subversion of the time in your life where you think every thought that you have is the most important thought that anyone's ever had." And
yeah,
that made it really easy for me to look past all of this like time capsule stuff that hasn't aged well to see to see that.
I always maintain that if you watch Girls as a bit of a satire.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it doesn't diverge from being a satire, but I think if you mostly view it as being satire, then it's one of the funniest things you will ever watch.
I feel the same way about the first season of Glee. I think the first season of Glee is a great satire.
I'm rewatching Glee right now, and it is fucking fantastic.
I think the first season is a great satire, and then at some point I start to lose the thread. But once again, I haven't seen it in like 10 years.
I've never seen it.
Ooh.
I can't.
Who's the outcast, Rachel?
I can't because I went to a theater college, essentially.
Yeah.
And
where April was bursting out in song.
Yes. If you weren't in a theater production, you were in an a cappella group. And my roommate in college, I think she used to do show choir. She loved it. She's a great singer. It's just not for me.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
You made a stunning admission on the show, so I will too. I got rejected from every a cappella group in Boston University.
Oh, I got rejected from the one I tried out for.
Jake?
I got rejected from every single frat.
Oh.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, like, I ended up being a sorority sweetheart for all my frat.
Love that.
Yay, Greek life.
So much, much better than being in a frat.
Jake, thank you so much again for joining us. You've been an amazing sport. And before we let you go, will you please tell us a bit about your new podcast, Therapus? I saw that you had Tate McRae on, and I'm very excited to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Therapist, actually, so funny. You think of, we're talking about like where we just have the idea of something and then we create based off of that. Therapist was created based off of the name. So I came up with the name Therapist and then I created the podcast based off of that.
You're just like Robin.
I'm just like Robin. And it's really just a podcast where, I mean, I kind of took inspiration from Girls in the sense that it's going to be like a little unapologetically dark comedy and also like truths that like we all feel, but like, are we going to say them? Like, it's fine. Like, let's give real honest advice and let's make it funny. And then I prescribe, because of my octopus, I prescribe kind of like a pop culture remedy in a sense to whatever they're going through.
Because
that's how
I cure whatever I'm going with through. Like, I watch.
Yes, that's like how I lived my whole childhood.
Yes, yes.
Instead of being Catholic and doing 10 Hail Marys, you have to watch the first season of Girls.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, literally. I gave a prescription the other day. I think it was, we were talking about some girl. They were all fighting over the same guy. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to prescribe to you John Tucker Must Die, right? Because then that shows like, you know what I mean?
Incredible movie.
Incredible movie, right? And they're going to watch
that.
That
is such a cool premise.
Yeah, it's cool. It's fun. It's fun to do. I have all my friends on. And, you know, Tate, who you were asking about, is a really close friend. And she was so awesome to have on, especially from someone who actually makes art, makes music. And so, yeah, it's cool. I got to prescribe her songs while she was on the show. So that was awesome.
I love that premise.
What day? I'm subscribing now. What day of the week does it come out?
Well, it comes out tonight at 9, every Wednesday at 9 p.m.
Every Wednesday at 9 p.m.
Pacific, midnight, Eastern. Yes.
Pacific, P-U-S-S.
Pacific.
Pacific. Oh, that's really smart.
Thank you. It's yours. And if people want to see shorter versions of your face and voice, perhaps vertically on their phone, where might they find you on other apps?
You can find me on TikTok at OctopusLover8, octopus with two S's, and then on Instagram at PassThatPuss.
Nice. Thank catchy. You. Love it.
Love that.
Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
I'm gonna check in with you weekly on my
Please.
Girl's progress.
I will. I'm looking forward to it. I'm holding you to it.
Yeah. Thank you.
He's going to blow up your phone every day.
I am.
On DM. All right. As long as you know, about girls.
Yeah.
Cool. That's it for this week. Thank you again for listening, and thank you again to our guest Jake Shane.
Please check out his podcast Therapus because it sounds fucking great. We have been in sync. We're edited by Katie Yonner, production coordinator Kyle Bosch, associate producer Lou Barron. Hi, Lou. Social media producer Dale Stamfley, executive producer Tommy West. Original music by Taylor Barefoot. We are a pro Taylor podcast. InSync is a production of Gotham West Studios. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok at the InSync Pod. Let us know what your favorite musical moment is in Girls, because apparently there are many.
So many.
And
watch Girls.
I'm going to watch Girls. And tune in next week when I guess we're just going to be talking about Girls again.
Honestly, I really want to be on that Girls podcast, the Girls Rewatch podcast.
Girls Rewatch podcast. If you're listening, hit us up. And until next time, I'm Aviv Rubenstein.
I'm Rachel Brodsky.
Saying, don't dance on your own.